Omaha Public Radio presents another program for Metropolitan Community College on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Byron Dandra Ory, professor and chairman of the Department of Political Science at Jackson State University in Jackson, Mississippi. Dr. Ory's topic will be A Black President in My Lifetime, Notes from a Black Professor. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, February 12, 2009, for broadcast at this time. This event was co-sponsored by the Social Action Commissions of the Omaha Alumni Chapter of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority and the Beta Upsilon Chapter of Omega Psi Phi Fraternity. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Metropolitan Community College, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is James Mason, Jr., Vice Basileus of the local chapter of Omega Psi Phi.
It is indeed a pleasure and honor to present to some and introduce the others, Dr. Byron Dandra Ory. He is a professor and chair of political science at Jackson State University in Jackson, Mississippi. He served as assistant and associate professor of political science at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln from the fall of 2001 to the spring of 2008. At the University of Mississippi in Oxford, Mississippi, he held the position of assistant professor of political science and Afro-American studies from 1991 to 2001. I guess his brother's doing a lot of 10-year stints here. Brother Andre, or Dr. Ory, his primary area of interest include race and politics, political behavior, political opinion, and institutions. He has researched the impact of the Voting Rights Act by exploring the effects of the election of the minority legislators. He also continues work on the origins of black racial conservatism by exploring interracial attitudes of African Americans. In addition to his PhD in political science from the University of New Orleans, Professor Ory has earned a BS in business administration from Mississippi Valley University, a master's of public administration from the University of Mississippi, and a master's of political science from the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Is that like upstate or?
Long Island.
Oh, okay. It's not the big house?
Hampton. Jay-Z. You gotta have a little money.
Okay. His presentations and lectures include stops at Yale University, Spelman College, Washington University, and Oxford University. And I can tell you that this brother is as comfortable at Oxford University as he is with Spelman. And backed by popular demand, Dr. Ory returns to Metropolitan Community College following two previous lectures during Black History Month in 2007 and 2008. In previous years, we have followed his research on the politics of voting rights, including representation and redistricting, and then race and gender in the Obama-Clinton race. You know, it's very seldom you find a brother that is wide versed as Dr. Ory is. As I stated, he is just as comfortable at Spelman as he is at Oxford. But this is a brother that he's not often regulated. He usually regulates. So as he turns up the temperature in the room, I hope that everybody will be respectful, take off your jacket or whatever, but leave the rest on, because this is a brother that's truly, when it speaks of this subject and he's in front of the mic, he becomes the PhD that he is. So without further ado, I introduce to some and present to others Dr. Dandra Ory, PhD, professor, and chair of political science at Jackson State University.
Thank you, Dr. Mike. Thank you. Before I get started, I'd like to say thanks to all of y'all for coming out. Nice Q Delta reunion. Good way to come home and be able to get back on someone else's quarter. I really appreciate the opportunity coming back here. We had a great time earlier doing the Metro and More television show. We had a really, really lively discussion. I had an opportunity to get the DVD from the one that we did last year, and I've shown it to the students, and it's really, really high quality work that they do here at the community college. It's really comparable to a four-year university as it relates to the facilities they have here, and very, very, very nice guest quarters. The title of the talk tonight is A Black President in My Lifetime, and like some other folk who I hang with, maybe some of you here today, I never would have thunk, excuse the lack of grammatical correctness there, but you'll get enough of that tonight. I never would have thought this would have happened in my lifetime. It's not that I am so old that I am fixated in the civil rights movement. It's just that, as you'll see, I have become disillusioned as it relates to equality in the United States, whether it be along the lines of race, gender, or class. And so in this presentation, I'd like to, one, revisit the election and conduct what we would consider a post hoc analysis, because as many of you all know, I did not or could not have predicted this to have happened based on any of the expertise that I have acquired over the years. And so what I'd like to do is to first look at the primary election and then segue into the general election and then illustrate or revisit why I got it wrong and give others the opportunity to say why they got it right. Look at Brother Chris Rogers. What does President Obama's election mean for race relations in this country? And then I'd like to talk beyond the academic experience as it relates to my own personal experience from the convention, where Chris and I actually missed each other but talked about the very next day after the presentation that Barack Obama gave during his national conventions or his Democratic convention speech, the appointment or the adoption of Sarah Palin as a vice presidential candidate. He was on his way back to Nebraska, and we had about a 30-40 minute conversation about that immediately following the choice. And then I'd like to just open it up for comments, and we're going to just kind of keep it really, really leisure, and we can discuss all gamuts as it relates to the talk. So if we go back to the primary, I don't know what happened in Iowa. I don't know whether or not it was the Oprah effect. To some extent, I not only have the systematic evidence to actually tease this out. Ultimately, I'm sure that some of my colleagues will revisit this and give a more systematic attention to it. But caucuses sometimes may, in fact, be beneficial for marginalized groups. Why? It takes really highly educated folk or folks with higher education relative to those with less education to participate in caucuses. Why? One, there's a cost. You're taking an hour or so of your time to go to something that looks like this, and it's really a meeting of the minds, if you will, and you determine who that candidate will be based on your nomination. And it's a 1-2-3-tier type process. So whereas typically folks are deterred from participating in the political process because of, you know, having to use their time, take time off to go and do that, caucuses may, in fact, encourage more highly educated folk. The higher your education, the more progressive or the more liberal you are because of the more facts you have as it relates to the topic, and therefore you are less likely to dismiss those facts as conservatives typically will do as it relates to status quo and maintaining a certain belief. South Carolina, well, South Carolina, I think this was somewhat troubling for black folk and others in the United States, because this is when they found out that Bill Clinton can play a saxophone, but that he's a politician. And so Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton really got caught on using the Southern strategy a bit too early. The Southern strategy often is used in elections to try and mobilize the South by using sometimes explicit racial cues or sometimes by using implicit racial cues. For example, Willie Horton was an explicit racial cue. It was a black, woolly-headed man that looked like a criminal as it relates to how criminals are depicted in this country. And so Willie Horton had actually gone out in Massachusetts. They gave him furlough, meaning that he could go home for the weekend as a criminal, and he raped and beat up a couple, raped the woman and beat her husband. Well, Michael Dukakis was then governor of Massachusetts. And so George H.W. Bush, the father of George W. Bush, actually made use, or Lee Atwater was responsible, really, for using that commercial to create sort of a racial divide, if you will. It was an explicit racial cue that showed him being furloughed, meaning that he was actually leaving out of the penitentiary gates. And then they said, you know, basically some language as it relates to Dukakis. That linked Dukakis with Willie Horton. That's an explicit case. 1968, immediately following what some might call racial uprisings, others might call riots and Watts in the areas. President Nixon talked about law and order. Well, there were a lot of whites in the suburban areas of California who were really, really threatened. And that was, will these people leave their own backyards and stop burning their own backyards and then go out and burn some of our backyards and front yards? So that created a threat. And so you heard Nixon talk about law and order. You fast forward to President Reagan. President Reagan talked about the welfare queen with 6 or 7 different addresses, and she's really beating the system, essentially. And so these code words start manufacturing. You get to the Clinton. A lot of people don't talk about this or didn't talk about it prior to the South Carolina incident. But in 1992, during that particular election, Bill Clinton was coupled with what they call the Sister Soldier effect. And during that particular case, Sister Soldier had said basically that if black people would stop killing black people and take a week to kill white people, well, if you stop right there, I saw one sister look up like, wow. If you stop right there, it's just framed as if you take a week and kill white people, then everything would be okay. What she was saying, if you interpret it, and it may not even be up for discussion in terms of interpretation, but if I can see her interpreting that, saying that if they were to actually kill white people, then it would get the nation's attention. Well, Bill Clinton went to Jesse Jackson's backyard at the Rainbow Coalition. Jesse Jackson was throwing this big fundraiser for Bill Clinton, and he basically chastised the audience. It looked very much like this, but it was on television, and he was chastising Jesse Jackson. And that was to distance himself from Jesse Jackson. He said that, you know, if you would replace blacks with whites in Sister Soldier's statement and apply that to David Duke, then you'd get a racist. So you all need to stop letting these folk off the hook when they actually use commentary to address whites. And so that created a stir, in that Bill Clinton was able to distance himself from Jesse Jackson to make him more of a racial moderate candidate, something that he needed to do in order to win the national populace in terms of being able to get other Southerners to vote for him. So back to South Carolina, Bill Clinton basically used the word fairy tale, saying that, you know, come on now, this is a fairy tale. The media then interpreted that, or he could have actually meant that, Barack Obama could not by any means win the presidency of the United States, because that would be a fairy tale in this country, which is where my mind was. Hillary Clinton, during the same week almost as Martin Luther King's birthday, a little bit later, Hillary Clinton said that the Civil Rights Act was passed basically because of Lyndon Johnson, and that although Martin Luther King was a great preacher and he was a great grassroots mobilizer, civil rights legislation could not have been passed without Lyndon Johnson. Well, basically, she was minimizing the role of Martin Luther King. And so that was supposed to be a situation where she kind of distanced herself from the black community so that she wouldn't be marked as a liberal. Bill Clinton had already started to groom her with the Democratic Leadership Conference. That's one of the most conservative factions of the Democratic Party. She was a secretary on paper, and that was to actually create a resume whereby she could actually become or be perceived as a more of a moderate candidate. And so you get South Carolina after you leave New Hampshire, where New Hampshire's a primary. Now, he won, Barack Obama won the caucus in Iowa, but then he goes a week later to New Hampshire and loses. I think he lost badly. And then you go to South Carolina. The question is whether or not he's a viable candidate, whether or not he's black enough, so on and so forth. Well, in South Carolina, you have this incident that is hit with respect to Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, and black folks mobilized in full force to support Barack Obama. They were not in full force support of him prior to that. Why? The intersectionality of race and gender was an issue. Black women were wondering whether or not they should vote for a woman or should they vote for an African American. The choice was there. They were confused. South Carolina data showed that. I showed that the last time I was here. But then once those comments were made, they came together and they actually supported in full force Barack Obama. Barack Obama won South Carolina. A lot of folk saw that as meaning that he was winning southern states. Well, the fact of the matter is that when African Americans joined the Democratic Party after the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965, white people in the South started to party elsewhere. And so they stopped voting for the Democratic presidential candidate after 1965 and started to vote for other candidates, Republican and Independent. And I say that because in 1968 they actually supported George Wallace. And then Michigan and Florida. Michigan and Florida didn't happen. Had Michigan and Florida happened, Hillary Clinton would have actually won those two states. Had she won those two states, then you would have saw this snowball effect starting to take place that didn't take place. Super Tuesday hits. Barack Obama doesn't win. Some people say he won. Hillary Clinton did not win. Some people say that Barack Obama won. But either way, he's not knocked out of the race. Therefore, you don't get this bandwagon effect where folk are actually joining Hillary Clinton's team because the headlines read, Hillary wins, Hillary wins, Hillary wins. And folk actually end up starting to support her ticket. That didn't happen. What happened afterwards is actually, you know, what swung the election. So all those issues are extremely important. But then you get a bunch of no-name, no salient races that take place, one of which actually took place in this state. I was a part of it. You all probably were a part of it. We had a caucus here, and only 10% of the Democratic Party showed up to vote. Well, in Nebraska, first of all, you have to look at how many Democrats are in this state, and then if only 10% of them showed up to vote, that's a very, very small number. And so that goes back to some extent to support my position in terms of these caucuses are very small, and you get these highly educated folk who were actually supporting Barack Obama. And that's the ball game, basically. You know, that's how he wins the primary. And then we go to the general election. I think Howard Dean has to get some credit here. I didn't think that, I never would have thought this would have occurred, that he could actually fracture the South. And that was the logic behind my notion that he could not win the election. Howard Dean said that we should go to all 50 states, bar none. I mean, they put more money in some states, but he actually made an attempt to go to all of them. Some states, typically, you will just ignore because you know you can't win. For example, in the South, it's rare that, you know, a Democratic candidate will come to Mississippi because he knows it's going to be tough on them. But Howard Dean said we should go to every state, and that ultimately ended up working in their favor. Barack Obama ran a deracialized campaign, and so I don't know if ever the question was answered whether or not he was black enough. He was on BET, said he likes Jay-Z, so on and so forth. But if you go to the convention or when he did his speech, it was actually the timing. He talked about the 40-year anniversary of MLK. But he kind of hit that and boom, got out. It was like real quick. He barely touched that topic because he didn't want to, you know, I guess contaminate, I hate to use that word, but taint the election with race because of, you know, the history of this country. Another thing that I did not think would have as much of an impact on the election that did was the youth vote. Why? From a scientific perspective, you predict time B with time A. That's the most reliable prediction. That means that you'll look at the history and the pattern to actually end up predicting what's to come if you're going to forecast. Well, young folk had not voted. They have not been voting. So I didn't see there being as much of an impact as they were. But, of course, I was wrong. Why? Because Barack Obama took full advantage of this new wave of folks texting, so on and so forth, and he was able to mobilize a group who had previously almost been disenfranchised, even though we gave 18-year-olds the right to vote. They had never taken advantage of it. And many of those kids ended up voting, and there had been a huge impact on the college campuses, whether it be the war or whether it just simply being that, hey, this is a very, very smart man who deserves to be the president of the United States, regardless of what my parents say. Speaking of which, some of the kids, I believe, and I don't have empirical evidence for this, so I rarely would make a presentation without the empirical evidence, but it can be tested. And that is, I believe that as opposed to the parental socialization that you get, meaning that the parent will teach the kid and they'll rub off on them in life, in this particular case, I think that the kids were coming home basically asking the question, so what's wrong with this guy, Doc? Or what's wrong with this guy, Mom or Dad? Similar to the early 1970s, if you all remember the Kick the Habit campaign, when I would tell my parents, I thought you said you don't quit smoking. And ultimately, the more I said it, they actually quit smoking. So in this case, I think that, you know, parents had to reassess themselves. Traditional whites in this case may have actually looked at themselves and asked the same question, yeah, what is wrong with this guy? And then use a retrospective evaluation by looking at the current administration at that time relative to this guy. And we'll come back to this gal. Ultimately, though, I think it's very, very comparable to what Carville said in 1992 when Bill Clinton was elected. It's the economy, stupid. That explains it. Okay, the Palin effect. Unlike some, I thought that this was a very, very well-calculated strategy. And I thought that what was going to happen based on my research on race relations in this country, I actually compared this to King Kong with the white woman in his hand and folks trying to figure a way to wrestle away and rescue the white woman. Well, why do I say that? The dominant culture in this country is dominated by a white perspective. And so when you start looking at education, which I'll come back to in terms of, you know, how blacks are presented, say, in an American government textbook, and I'll come back to that. I thought that what they tried to do is create an us versus them. If they could create an us versus them, then they could actually clearly walk away with a majority of the votes because there are more whites in this country, and it would have created, although a xenophobic approach, it would have created this herding approach. Just like African Americans overwhelmingly, it's not just like, because there's a very different story behind why blacks support black candidates and progressive candidates. That's a very different story. So I won't say that. But it is social identity that you tend to, you know, align with in groups, groups who look like you, groups who think like you, so on and so forth. So there is a discussion there. But the herding effect would have taken place if they would have attacked Palin. And then she's been attacked by the liberal media, which is conflated oftentimes with welfare, race, crime, so on and forth, protecting crime, so on and so forth, more education, more spending. And then that would have actually ended up creating this us versus them phenomenon. Well, ultimately, whether or not that worked or not, I don't know the answer to that. So if you look at 9/11, you see McCain with about a 2-point lead, so to speak. And this is based on a number of surveys that were done during that time. So it actually pools all those surveys together and it plots them right on top of each other. Well, right around 9/11-ish, 9/25, you start to see a huge spike in the direction of Barack Obama. What took place between that time? Well, my frat brother Wayne Houston suggests that when Palin started opening her mouth and the more she did it, the more folks began to distance themselves from the McCain camp. I argue, on the other hand, that, yeah, that may have been, in fact, the case, but I don't think it is as much as the economy, because right between that time, the economy bottomed out. And so when you look for systematic explanations, I'm not embarrassed to say that I was wrong on this, because I don't think, although I'll give Chris Rogers the opportunity to speak his piece, I don't think someone could have systematically predicted it using, you know, variables that actually ended up working in the end. I think that it was strictly the economy, and there was no coming back, basically. Once the economy bottomed out, it was people voting their pocketbooks as opposed to these social issues, you know, that conservatives typically use, whether it be race, Hussein, Obama, Hussein, or whatever the case was, you know, abortion. I think folks just forgot about all that and said, I'm broke. Have you looked at my 401k plan? Did I lose 20,000? I'm speaking for myself. So folks were actually thinking about pocketbook voting. And they did a retrospective evaluation of the Bush administration. And then they made their decision, which is, some people might suggest that you heard a lot about the Bradley effect, that there was this reverse Bradley effect taking place. Bradley effect suggests that, that's why I was wrong again on that too. The Bradley effect suggests that people will say that they're going to vote for one candidate, and when they get in the voting booth, they'll pull the lever for another one, typically along the lines of race. And so you'll say that you'll vote for the black candidate, but then you go in and you pull the lever for the white. Well, this is typically an explanation for white voters. In this case, some might argue that there were white voters saying they were going to vote for McCain, and they just couldn't do it because their personal pocketbooks were at stake and their livelihood was at stake, and so they voted for Barack Obama. Again, I don't have empirical evidence for that. So why I got it wrong? Well, first of all, I have this activated ignorance that I will admit to, and that means that, you know, when you get caught up in one of your numbers and you get caught up in your theories, you have these blinders on, and those blinders for me are not strictly based on some theories, because there are probably some other theories out there that I didn't consider because of where I'm from and where I've lived. Now, I know that you all live in Nebraska. I've lived here for 7 years, and I'm back in Mississippi. And just like folks who lived in New York and were a part of what they call Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, where they can't make any changes to their elections unless it gets approved by the Department of Justice because of problems that were associated in the past. Well, it had nothing to do with race in New York. So here in Nebraska, when I compare living in Mississippi on race relations, you might say, well, how are you going to compare Nebraska to Mississippi? Well, I left Mississippi in 2001 to come here after they voted to keep the Confederate flag as a part of the state flag. I saw that as my exit option and a notice. Some say I ran, and some lady said that, oh, you know, I ran away. You'll be back, though. And, of course, I'm back now. The same year I left Nebraska, and I'm not gone officially, the same year that I left Nebraska, affirmative action was repealed. And so when I compare the two, I'm doing it based on the empirical evidence. And so my point is that because I've lived in these states, I didn't think there was no way, and whatever adage you want to use, you know, ice in a lower place or whatever you want to say, I didn't think that it was possible for Barack Obama to win, and it was based on, you know, my socialization in those states. Another point that I made, in fact, I made that point the last time I was here, that if you want to predict the election as it relates to an African-American becoming president, all you have to do is look at statewide elections. When and where have African-Americans won statewide elections in this country? Very, very few. Doug Wilder, governor, Massachusetts, Bill Patrick, Senators Obama, about three maybe, 1968 in Massachusetts, Senator. Either way you go, they're not many on one hand possibly in terms of this side of the Reconstruction. And so I didn't think that statewide he could do well when you had to win the entire state with the exception of Nebraska because of its Electoral College rules. The South didn't look good at all. And according to Earl and Merle Black and their research on the Vital South, they argue that so goes the South, so goes the election. And they're not saying that you have to win the majority of the South. Their position is you just have to fracture the South. And that simply did not look good. Why? Al Gore didn't win a single state, and he was migrated into Tennessee, but he was a white male who couldn't win a single state in the South. Kerry couldn't win a single state in the South. And so at the end of the day, it was my opinion that a black man couldn't win a single state in the South. Why? Because race relations would impair that as well as conservatism. So if we go back to 2000, the South is entirely red, meaning that Al Gore did not win a single state. In 2000, I say that this is what we call the bold L. In any election year, you can start in North Dakota, come down to Texas, and go across to Florida, and you get the Republican ale. Those votes are almost guaranteed for the Republican Party. And this one just happens to be a lot bolder, although it gives a misrepresentation because there are a lot of trees and grass in those states. What you really need is a cartogram that shows how they're weighted based on the electoral college vote. Now, if you look at 2008, this is where I really got it wrong. Because if you look at the South, and Bill Clinton was able to win four states in the South twice. He was a native son. Jimmy Carter was a native son. And I also got it wrong because I assumed that you needed to have at least a vice presidential candidate on your ticket that was from the South. And that's typically what the rule is. Virginia, which some argue Virginia has succeeded from the South because you got a lot of voters who live in Northern Virginia. They work for the government, and so they support the government, and they're more liberal. And then you get North Carolina. Now, North Carolina, I can't explain. Some argue that there was a high youth vote, high youth turnout in North Carolina, combined with, and almost running tit for tat, with the fact that North Carolina has a highly educated population, relatively speaking, in the South. And that is because they have the research triangles, and they have quite a bit of colleges and universities in the South, which actually would suggest that you get more educated folk. And one guy gave me one anecdotal piece that, you know, you can play around with. Well, I'm not going to say that. But what I would like to point out is that Nebraska, definitely Omaha, needs to be patted on the back because the second congressional district is, I think, a direct impact of Howard Dean's 50-state plan, the fact that he actually targeted this area and they won it. I think that speaks to, since, you know, the discussion is on race and politics, if you compare the second congressional district to the rest of this country, to the rest of this state, you have more diversity here relative to the rest of the state. That kind of runs counter to the old racial threat hypothesis, which suggests that in those areas where there are high concentrations of African Americans, whites will be more threatened. The flip side of that is that whites actually get to know African Americans, they get to know other cultures. Native Americans are here, African Americans are here, Hispanics are here, and they have the opportunity to actually meet and greet folk in an urban setting. That's not the case of what you get in the suburbs, or nor is it the case that you get in the rural areas. You just get what you see on television, basically. And so I think that actually played a huge role. Well, what do myself and this guy have in common? Well, one, yes, we do this quite a bit, and he's not ashamed. I can see myself actually getting to be his age, and I look proud. I can look back and proudly say that, well, he did it. He was 60 years old. I can still do it. Dr. Thunder. Well, it's not only that we are both mega men, but we're both disillusioned liberals and radical egalitarianists. We're no different than Michelle Obama. All right, what I mean by that? You're going to tell me that. Michelle Obama and Reverend Wright have something in common. Well, what do we mean by this disillusioned liberalism? This is this notion that we live in a land of equality. You go back to the precept, whatever you want to go back into the constitutional framing, inalienable rights, all men are created equal. But then when you look, or when some African Americans or some ethnic groups look in their communities to see that equality does not exist as it's supposed to exist, there's this disillusioned feeling. For example, Jackson State University received, and Mississippi Valley State and Alcorn State and the state of Mississippi, received disproportionately less money at state universities than the traditional white institutions, Mississippi State, University of Mississippi, the University of Southern Mississippi. There was a court case, Ayers versus Fordyce, whereby the courts remanded back to the states that you pay redress to these state-supported universities because you have not been giving them the same amount of money. Well, that's not a case where you can blame the school. Some would say, well, it's just poor management on the part of HBCUs, that they're not as successful as these schools. It's also the fact that they have not been receiving the comparable amount of money. And so that's actually been illustrated through the course. I use that not as an extreme case, because you can also look, and this was in 1995. Just as recently, you can look at the 1990s, Pickford versus Glickman, which was a case about farmers. Black farmers receiving disproportionately the number or amount of money that they needed as it related to subsidies. In the years that they did not do well in farming, white farmers were given disproportionate, you know, subsidies or loans when compared to the black farms. And of course, the black farmers ended up losing their land. And so you can look back just as recent as the 1990s to show that these inequalities persist. And so people like this, like Reverend Wright and myself and Michelle Obama, when she says, for the first time, basically, I feel like an American, when she started to see the love that white America was giving to Barack Obama. And that was an attempt to create or to paint a picture of her being unpatriotic. And that American identity has often been conflated with, as one of my colleagues at Nebraska is doing some research on, you know, how do you explain American identity? One of the strongest variables that she has is that American identity can be explained by these borders. What are the borders? One, you're white, and two, you're Christian. And so when you explain or you say, who is an American? The majority of Americans would say, do you have to be white? Do you have to be Christian? And quite a bit of Americans actually suggest that that is who is American in this country, of which Obama and Michelle were not, although Obama, Michelle, clearly not. And so that's why the attack on Michelle, because Obama had a link to whiteness, whereas Michelle was clearly an African-American woman. And then Reverend Wright, the same. So one thing I can conclude, that we both love America. In protest, oftentimes, even at the convention, I have illustrated my disillusionment where I would typically I put my left hand on my right heart, but you don't have a heart on your right side. General Six, Oscar Grant, these are all incidents that keep me reminding myself that regardless of who's in the White House, these incidents occur. Oscar Grant, all of you have probably heard by now, was shot in the back while laying down, face down, being accosted by and subdued by BART officials, transportation officers. For whatever reason, he was shot in the back. He was unarmed, and he was an African-American. In any of these cases, or when these cases occur, whether it be Rodney King, I'm always interested in knowing whether or not there's an equal and opposite case as it relates to whites. And I just don't hear of them happening if they do happen. And so that sort of gets at, you know, this disillusionment. And radical egalitarianism simply means that, you know, we want equality and we want it now. There's no compromise on that. Rights are rights, and the individual rights should be respected for each individual. So what does President Obama's election do for race relations in this country? I think right away it helps with the positive stereotypes of African Americans in this country. At current, negative stereotypes persist, and I think that the First Family has already sort of changed, you know, how young African Americans see themselves. Malia and Sasha, I remember when I was at the inauguration, and one of the radio personalities said that he already sees Barack Obama having an impact, or the First Family having an impact, because this woman was walking with her kids, and young lady was all over the place. And she said, you straighten up right now. And she said, do you see Malia and Sasha up there acting like that? Do you see how they sitting up there and they looking up, you know? So, you know, right away, people are actually making use of the First Family in terms of, you know, trying to maintain law and order. No, I'm just kidding. This is a real world positive image, though, relative to what folks were actually really, some people criticized the Cosby series, you know, while many of us applauded it. There were those suggesting that this was not a real world family. relative to the mainstream or the average African-American family. And, you know, even if Obama's family is not the norm, it at least actually gives a real world case, as opposed to, you know, a prison inmate, which helps to exacerbate those negative stereotypes, because turn on the television in any urban setting, the first or second story you get is a crime that's actually taking place. And, you know, there's a choice by the media to show that, where they show it. But they choose to show it when they show it as one of the first presentations, which is, you know, it just simply sensationalizes crime. And there's actually some research that shows that people who see these stories are more likely to have negative stereotypes, go figure, of African Americans. So another thing that it can do, or along the same lines rather, is demystify stereotypes. Kathy Cohen and her research from the University of Chicago suggests that stereotypes of blacks have great staying power. So when you go back to when African Americans first came to the United States and post-slavery, when they began to serve in political officials or political elected offices after Reconstruction, you started to see these cartoons where they were suggesting that black folk were lazy, they didn't work hard, they were they didn't have willpower, they were unintelligent. Well, many of those stereotypes exist today, clearly. Relative to the Irish, who were not only told that if you assimilate with the white culture or the mainstream culture in the United States, you could become an American, which eventually they did. But if you actually increase your disdain or hatred toward blacks, that will actually move you in the direction of being an American, which is actually what happened. Blacks themselves, there's an excellent opportunity for blacks to improve their own images of themselves. The research that we actually did today, and I'll go ahead and debrief on that. Well, let me just make this point as it relates to the textbook first and miseducation. I'm on the testing and development committee for the advanced placement exam that's given nationwide. And so that means I write with about five other people. We write the exam. We go to Princeton and New York every year. And I've been having this quarrel over what type of items you can use on the exam. And of course, based on my research and based on reality, you know, I want to use some stuff based on race. Well, there seems to be a lot of resistance to that. One of the problems is that the teachers use the textbook. And because the textbook is a mainstream textbook, it starts with black folks being shown as slaves. And then it discusses the three-fifths compromise. And then you fast forward to civil rights. And in civil rights section, you get basically a dependent group needing the government to bail them out of whatever problems they have. And then you fast forward and you'll see in some of the social welfare chapters, an African-American mother, some children, so on and so forth. And so students are being socialized through the agent of education to see blacks as being this inferior group. And so it's manifested through education. And what I see the possibility or the potential here is that through self-help, because this is not going to be like, you know, manna falling down from heaven for you church folk. It's going to be, you know, the land of milk and honey, but you have to remember how that was actually derived. And I probably should let Rev, the two Revs in here, explain that. I've been in trouble misquoting. But it actually would be the case where they have to engage in hard work. The land of milk and honey didn't come, you know, from Canada just like, you know, boom, here it is, you know. Oh, whoop, there it is. I get all that confused. It actually comes from hard work. So I think that what you'll see is that there will be opportunities for various ethnic groups, various classes, in terms of, you know, lower class, urban versus rural, so on and so forth. There will be a lot of opportunities, but they'll have to seize on those opportunities. For example, with the stimulus package, one of the representatives in Mississippi was saying that, you know, we have legislators who have not read the stimulus package. So in other words, they're not prepared to, on day after a stimulus package is passed to actually move forward in terms of putting together a plan and submitting that proposal to actually receive whatever might be there for them to receive. Another frat brother where who has actually been critical of the black community for personally being irresponsible. Well, Obama actually has suggested that not only should we blame the government, but we should also take a look at self. He talked during Father's Day on last year, where he said that, you know, black men need to take personal responsibility for their kids, so on and so forth. Well, while that might be the case, what you did in that experiment was to read a narrative. And the narrative was designed to, it's an experimental manipulation. You know, I forgot I was coming back to Nebraska. I didn't think about it. And I forgot that I had Jason Wagner. He doesn't know that he's actually being used as an author. And some of you all might know Jason Wagner. So it automatically shows you that that's a fictitious piece. But you read the article, and the purpose was to see whether or not that influences you to answer the survey in a certain way. So there were six manipulations that we used. We used one where Obama blamed black people for their for the inequalities that persist in America. We used one where Obama blamed the government for the inequalities, like the education, failed education system, so on and so forth. And then we look at, does the messenger matter? So we look at Bill Cosby, same messages, same words, where he actually blames black folks, blames the government. We look at Joe Biden, so we look at race, and Jay Leno. So we try to get two comparable black and white individuals to see whether or not it impacts. And it actually does. And so when Obama says some of the things he says, it does move African Americans to be more conservative. That could pose a problem. Why? Well, yes, I would concede that some of these problems are problems that need to be addressed in terms of, you know, parents need to step up and be parents, so on and so forth. But the problem I have, or the concern I have, is that it may lull the community to sleep as it relates to protesting some problems that are in the community, such as, you know, the Ayers case that was in Mississippi regarding unequal funding. That was not about the university not making use of the resources that it was appropriated. It was a case where the university was not being appropriated equally. And so if they, in fact, get to the point, or the community gets to the point, or progressives get to the point where, you know, we have a riot, that could pose a problem. Well, based on my personal experiences, you know, this was kind of difficult. You know, when you work in the capacity that I work in, the capacity of being a political scientist and trying to be an objective one, whereby I really like my empirical evidence to speak for itself, and I really do believe the data. Sometimes I probably need to step back and assess, you know, other explanations. Despite me being critical and suggesting, you know, like I did a blog where I said, you know, Democrats need to be concerned about this choice that Palin is placed on the ticket. Well, somebody has to do some kind of critical thinking. You know, everybody can't be hurrah, 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 and no one's, you know, stepping back thinking. But that can lead folks to believe that you are on the other side or something. That's a Republican. You're a conservative. You know, someone actually came up to me and said, well, I don't know why this woman sent me over here. She said, you're a Republican. So let's get that squared away right away. That's the reason that I went into political science, is to, you know, address some of these social ills that take place in the community, as well as these injustices. You know, this is just the experience we had in terms of how many folk were at the convention. You know, you got line wrapped around. I mean, it was chaos. And then I actually flew into Philadelphia for the inauguration. Why? No, not necessarily because of a cheaper ticket. But I wanted to take my son to where they actually framed the Constitution, so I could unframe it for him, so that he could see, you know, for himself, yeah, George Washington had slaves that was buried right there. And that's how they found out, because the archaeologists came in. So I wanted him to see that. And we were always deliberately 2 hours late for anything that took place, because I didn't want to deal with the traffic. So we did go to 30th Street Station, where, you know, Obama took off to start his route to the White House, but we were about 2 hours late. But he probably wouldn't have appreciated it anyway. I think that's it for me.
You've been listening to a program from the Metropolitan Community College Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Byron Dandra Ori, professor and chairman of the Department of Political Science at Jackson State University in Jackson, Mississippi. Dr. Ori's topic was A Black President in My Lifetime, Notes from a Black Professor. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, February 12, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Shayla O'Connor, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at Metropolitan Community College, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.